Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour on the show, is the dumbing down of American culture threatening our democracy? Commentator Susan Jacoby says that anti-intellectualism and anti-rationalism are flourishing in America in a mix that includes addiction to infotainment, every form of superstition and credulity, and an educational system that does a poor job of teaching not only basic skills, but the logic underlying those skills. Susan Jacoby quotes Thomas Jefferson, who said, "If a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be." We'll find out more. Among Susan Jacoby's books, Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism, her new book is The Age of American Unreason. Welcome to Open Line, Susan Jacoby. Good to have you here.
Glad to be talking to you this morning.
And we're at 614-292-8513. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email comments or question to openline@wosu.org. Susan, you say we have, and I'll quote you, an ignorant and anti-intellectual culture. Tell us more about that.
Well, I think ignorant and anti-intellectual, also anti-rational. I called it the age of American unreason for a reason. Anti-intellectualism and anti-rationalism aren't exactly the same thing. Anti-intellectualism is kind of a suspicion of people who use too many big words and that sort of thing. Dwight Eisenhower, President Eisenhower in the 50s, described an intellectual as someone who takes more words than he needs to tell more than he knows.
Right.
It's funny, actually.
Yeah, right.
Anti-rationalism is something else. Anti-rationalism is a chronic disbelief of evidence, saying, even if the evidence shows one thing, I don't care what the evidence shows, I believe this. You might say, for example, that although it's been conclusively disproved that Saddam Hussein had anything to do with the 9/11 attacks, a very large percentage of the American public still believes that Saddam Hussein did have something to do with the 9/11
yes.
attacks, even though the president and the vice president even have admitted it wasn't so. So if you say something enough, no amount of evidence to the contrary will convince people. As we talked about earlier, there are people who are absolute deniers of global warming, even though the evidence is all around us. They'll pick the two scientific people in the world as opposed to 1,000 who are also global warming deniers.
Well, Susan, where would this come from that somebody would say, look, I don't care what the evidence shows, I believe what I believe, and the heck with the evidence? I mean, in a personality, where does that arise?
Well, it's really not. I don't think in any individual person it's that uncommon. A lot of us reject evidence in our own lives because it's something we don't want to hear. But I think in the United States today, it also feeds into a couple of things. First of all, and I don't want to overemphasize it, because a lot of liberal intellectuals tend to blame everything that's wrong in our educational system on religious fundamentalism. It is true, however, that a third of Americans believe that the Bible is literally true, which is an astonishingly high proportion for a developed country. Now, I'm not talking about religion in general. There are all kinds of religious people who also accept evolution, and you can believe in God and evolution too.
Yes.
But what you cannot do is believe that every word in the Bible is literally true, that the earth was literally created in 6 days, and accept evolution. The two don't go together. So while those people are not a majority in America, they are a much larger minority. A third is not a small number of people than in any country in the developed world. And so for a lot of people, there is a direct conflict between the evidence of science and their faith. And I think this plays into something important. And then there's something else that has nothing to do with religion at all, which I think the media have played an enormous role in. The idea is somehow the truth is always at the exact equal distance between two points, so that you have one person on a TV show, saying that the sun revolves around the earth, and you have another one saying the Earth revolves around the sun, and they're both given equal weight. And we see that all the time with scientific and medical issues on television, that the individual experience of an emotional person is given the same weight as a scientific study of 10,000 people.
Yeah, I guess that's maybe journalists bending over backwards, and I guess too far backwards, to be fair.
Yeah, because two and two make four. They don't make five. It's the equivalent of, you know, having somebody come on and say two and two make five, and then the journalist said, mathematicians, however, say that two and two still make four. Two and two make four. That's all there is.
Yeah. The media, you fault the media for far more than that, right? I mean, it's that, but it's many other things as well, huh?
Well, I don't think in general that the media have given us a very good evidence-based approach to any issue. Now, I'll give you an example which is more current and more political. The tragic death of Tim Russert last week brought forth, frankly, what I consider an orgy of self-congratulation on the part of the journalistic profession in both the print and the broadcast media, because Meet the Press always was a civilized conversation. But the fact is, in the run-up to the Iraq War, when the administration was claiming that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and that as Vice President Cheney famously said on Meet the Press, we will be greeted as liberators, neither Tim Russert nor television news nor print journalists did their job during the run-up in the war. They didn't ask the questions. They didn't ask any evidence-based questions. And so that this kind of lack of demand for evidence, if popular sentiment, you know, goes otherwise, is something that the press has a lot to answer for, and it affects coverage of a whole range of issues.
Sure. It's true they did not ask those questions, and there are mea culpas, a big mea culpa on the front page of the New York Times. Bob Edwards then hosted Morning Edition at National Public Radio.
Yeah, but by then it was too late.
Oh, yeah, way too late. Sure.
We were years into the war, and Tim Russert and television news and print news, they all didn't do their jobs during the run-up to the war. And just the idea that just because on Meet the Press people don't scream at each other like they do on Rush Limbaugh, that you're getting evidence-based serious inquiry is wrong. And I think that the press using the occasion of Mr. Russert's tragic and untimely death to congratulate itself about how great American journalism is, frankly, disgusted me.
Well, you know, of course, you set the example of the run-up to the Iraq War and the failure of the media to ask pertinent questions and look for evidence-based answers, and that's, of course, true. Is that an unusual example, or do you see that across the board?
I think partly, you know, the transition from the culture of print to the culture of video has played a big role in this, because the more we get our information from video images, whether it's shouting heads, and not talking heads, but shouting heads on cable TV, or video clips on YouTube, the less time there is to ask whether is this really true. I'm not making any brief for the print media either. The New York Times and the Washington Post were two very bad offenders in the run-up to the war, papers for which I have respect and have written for many times over the years. But there is one thing about print that's different, which is it's down there. If it doesn't seem quite right to you, you can look at it, think about it, go and look for some other alternative sources. The information you get from video is quicker. Half the time, you know, I watched the Today Show for maybe a half hour after getting up this morning, as I always do. I can't remember a thing that was on the Today Show. I can remember what was in my newspaper this morning. But whatever information the Today Show is passing on, I can't check it out because I don't remember it, and neither does most of America.
Sure.
I have a fleeting impression. So if you'll remember in the early euphoric stages of the war in Iraq, the video images of the statue of Saddam Hussein being toppled in Baghdad, very powerful images. Nobody asked any questions about what reality lay behind that symbolic made-for-TV event. And this is why video, as a means of getting information, while it can reveal things about people that they used to be able to get away with, is not a very good contributor to serious dialogue on long term.
Well, as you pointed out, it's inherent in the medium, right? Because we're not going to take...
It's inherent in the medium.
Yeah, because we're not going to take
It's inherent in the video medium on computers, too. It's no different. The flashing image you see on YouTube, you may catch somebody out in a word you wouldn't have heard before, but it doesn't give you much background about anything.
Well, at least on YouTube, I can take a little clip, and I can move the little indicator back, and I can hear the words again, and I've done this, and I hear them a second time and hear them a third time, which is not something you could do on television, for example.
Well, actually, you'll soon be able to do it on television,
too.
I think television is going to be just another computer very soon, but I don't think that's how most people use YouTube.
No.
You're in the news business.
Right.
And I don't think that's how most of us use. I think most of us use the web, those of us who use it for research, as I do, too. We use it like vultures. We're sort of swooping down for a piece of information to fit into a story, and we don't look too much for the context of it.
Right. Susan Jacoby's new book is The Age of American Unreason. We're at 614-292-8513, and you can email questions or comments to openline@wosu.org. Susan, you point out that newspapers haven't been necessarily all you'd like them to be, and citing the Iraq War as one example. But nonetheless, as you point out, you can pick them up, put them down. You can read that paragraph again.
Yeah,
you can read it a third time.
Yeah, it's why newspapers are in so much trouble. People don't want to take the time to do that anymore.
Why don't people want to take the time to do that anymore?
Well, I think it's a result, really, of 35 years of a relentlessly shortened attention span by the entire culture of infotainment. Look, it's only 25 years ago, Neil Postman, who is dead, wrote a very prescient book called Amusing Ourselves to Death. This was written before PCs, so that he was only talking about the video culture in terms of television and cable television. He wrote it before PCs, but PCs have only increased this in the sense that, yes, everyone talks about the wonderful information of the centuries at our feet, or so to speak, at the tip of the click of a mouse, on computers. But the fact is that isn't how most of us use it. What computers have also done is shortened our attention span, so that taking the time to read something for a very long time is not something people want to do. The proof of this is 10 years ago, newspapers thought their online editions were going to save them. Hasn't proved to be true. What they thought was is that people under 35 who don't hardly read newspapers at all anymore were going to read the online editions just because it was online. But in fact, the proportion of under 35 people who read online is no greater than it is for print newspapers. And the other thing we know is that people who read newspapers online read less. They tend to do a hit just on the particular thing that they're interested in. You know, the days of reading the newspaper cover to cover, whether print or online, are pretty much gone for people in their 30s.
I guess that's one of the difficulties. You self-edit online, and you're going to probably self-edit in terms of your own prejudices and preconceptions, right?
Right. Well, and also then there's the huge online political commentary, and this is something that's very important and is also part of anti-intellectualism as well as anti-rationalism. We really, as Americans, we tend to tune out any voice that's not our own. People who are on the left will go to the Huffington Post. People who are on the right will go to the Drudge Report. There are very few people, except people who are news hounds in the business, who seek out things online that contradict their preconceptions. So what we engage in is not so much a political dialogue on a lot of these websites as just a reinforcement of the opinions that we already hold.
You know, I'm wondering if I remember studies, communications theory studies back in the 50s that talked about selective exposure. That is to say, we tend to expose ourselves to messages to which we already agree.
Yeah.
So I wonder if this is anything new.
Well, you know what? It's not new, but it's worse. And certainly, certainly in the 19th century, in the era in which lectures performed the function of TV, lectures were the only public entertainment, millions of Americans went to hear speakers with whom they did not agree. It was like going to a sporting event almost. we had in 1876 Thomas Henry Huxley, who was the great British popularizer of Darwin's theory of evolution, came over here to talk to Americans about evolution. And his halls were packed with thousands of people. And they certainly, evolution was more controversial then, and America was more religious then than it is now. And these people were engaging in what was once an American pastime, which is seeing for yourself whether the devil really had horns. I think one of the things that the video culture and the digital culture has done is it's because it provides so much opportunity to entertain ourselves with what we already agree with, we sort of shut out alternative forms of information that might challenge our preconceptions. I wouldn't say that it's anything new. I would say that it's more so. And there's a point at which differences in degree, I think, become differences in kind.
Sure. Susan Jacoby, my guest, the age of American unreason. Let's go to our phones. Caller from the Short North. Hi, caller.
Hi. Wonder if the guest has any familiarity with cognitive science, such as George Lakoff, and how that would relate to your subject?
A bit, but could you be more specific?
Well, what Lakoff says is that people perceive the world in terms of frames, which
yes.
is, and if the world doesn't fit the frames, if the facts don't fit the frames, they don't reject the frames. They
reject
the facts. And that seems to fit perfectly with what you're saying. But if we try and out-logic those people, we're going to lose. You have to figure out how to freeze it in terms of frames.
Well, I think that he's right about that. But also, the fact is that he's absolutely right about that. Everyone sees the world through a frame. But I would say that almost all human progress has depended on persuading people to reframe. And that's the question, is how you do that. In other words, how do you get people to see something through a different frame?
Mm-hmm.
If the fact is that people do sometimes change their frames, or we would still believe that the sun revolves around the earth, not that the earth revolves around the sun. There are periods in history where frames change, and they usually change because the weight of evidence becomes too great for people to sustain frames which are patently irrational.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt. Are you familiar at all with Thomas Kuhn, the History of Scientific Revolutions?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, his premise, which seems to make a lot of sense, is people really don't change that much. What happens is the people with the old views die, and the younger people that are open-minded at that point supplant what they stood for before. So,
well, you know, I've read that, but that in a way is, it kind of begs the question, because the fact is just dying isn't enough, because the history shows us that why did those people lose the ability to transmit their beliefs to the next generation? That's what I mean about a changing frame. In other words, just saying that people with old, outdated ideas die isn't enough.
No, I understand.
Because it doesn't explain why for centuries people with those ideas are able to make the next generation believe it, and suddenly they're not.
Mm-hmm. You occasionally get some people that can do that, that, you know, there are some people that think logically despite the frames, and they frequently are able to persuade a younger generation, but you have to have a sort of an unusual combination of circumstances to get people like that.
I think that's right. And if the environment is bad, but I think one of those circumstances that enables the frame to change is a certain crucial accumulation of evidence. I think, for example, it's pretty clear to me, we don't know what the political results are going to be, that the frame about global warming, which only 10 years ago was, oh, who cares about what those experts have to say? They're always predicting gloom and doom. The frame through which Americans view global warming, whether they're willing to actually do anything about it is another question. But the frame has changed in the last 10 years. And it's changed not because older people have died off, but because there's an accumulation of evidence which a lot of people can't ignore.
Mm-hmm. Caller, thank you. Let's go on to our next caller here. Hello, Paul. You're on the line.
Fred, good morning. Maybe I'm off base with what I'm going to say, and you can correct me if I am, but the media, in my opinion, has framed President Bush's efforts in the war. I think you were talking about this topic earlier. And one thing that I have come to realize is there's a very broad generalization applied by the media for the term weapons of mass destruction. And nobody has ever really sat down and said, oh, this is what a weapon of mass destruction is, and the media just feeds on it. And I don't think they do much to get into the reality of what we're talking about. They're happy to accept a broad generalization of something without defining it.
Hmm. Susan, what do you think?
I wouldn't know about that. I mean, I think weapons of mass destruction are generally understood by people as well as the media as either mass chemical weapons or mass nuclear weapons. I don't really see weapons of mass destruction as all of that complicated thing. But here's something else. I'm very hard on the media. And what the media will say is they don't do this and this and this because people aren't interested in it. Well, here's an interesting thing. In the last few months, the war in Iraq has basically disappeared from major news coverage. It's not anything that the media is covering very much of. And it's not just the other day, 51 people were killed in a bombing. And it really was very low news. And what people in the newsrooms will tell you is Americans aren't very interested in this. This is something they don't like. They're against the war. They want it to stop continuing. But it's not front page news. Why? Because American casualties have been down somewhat over the last 6 months. But then what do you do? And so the surge is working. But the surge is working so well that John McCain says, we can't leave. Well, if the surge is working, originally the point of the surge is that the surge would work, the Iraqis would take over this wonderful country that they have, and American soldiers could come home. Now, I think the fact that people – I think the media say with some justification, Americans at the moment, because of the economy, aren't that much interested in the war in Iraq. But again, that's really an example of what a short attention span we have, that literally bombs have to be exploding in our television set. Somebody has to attack us on our soil before we're thinking about a story that really has unfolded over the last 7 years.
Paul, what do you think?
Well, my feeling, again, Fred, is this. You know, and it may sound like I'm making a political statement. I'm not trying to, but really trying to get down to the basis of it, is that your guest there said, well, we don't know that much about weapons of mass destruction, and it's a very broad generalization. But
no, I didn't say that.
Well, excuse me, that was my interpretation. Let me put it that way. My interpretation is this. You look at a weapon of mass destruction like they used in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Okay, then you look at the rounds that Saddam Hussein used against the Iranians. They were full of nerve gas. But the point of it is, people keep saying Saddam Hussein did not have weapons of mass destruction. My point of contention is he did, and the media did not go and delve deep enough into the reality of it to define that terminology.
I did hear some discussion in the media of what constituted a weapon of mass destruction. Everybody realized that nuclear bombs did, you know, mass casualties. Everybody realized that biological weapons would have that potential if they could be effectively released. That was a big question. Chemical weapons, there was some disagreement as to whether they were weapons of mass destruction, as to whether per incident you could have that many casualties. I did hear some destruction of that.
So did I. But what the caller is saying is, if the media had defined weapons of mass destruction as he does, then you can still say that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. But we didn't find any, did we?
Yes, we did. As a matter of fact, they did. They found a number of caches of weapons in the desert where he had used them in long-range artillery.
None of them in any way able to be used at long distance. I'm not going to argue about this.
The issue is that that's what I'm saying. That, in my opinion, that's where the media is flawed.
Hmm.
Yeah, you think finding a cache of weapons that they didn't have any delivery system for means that Bush was right all along?
All they did was bury the munitions.
I don't know where you're getting your information from. I really don't.
I got it off the evening news. Okay? That's where I saw it. Well, I know what I saw. But the issue was, and not to mention I have a military background.
I'm not surprised.
Well,
there are lots of major military officers who have spoken out and said that we did not find weapons of mass destruction. But I guess you don't agree with those military officers.
Well,
that's all right, Fred. That was just a point I wanted to make. I felt the media wasn't quite doing their job.
Okay,
and all.
Paul. Thanks for your call. We're going to take a break here, and we're going to come back, call this with you, Susan Jacoby, her new book, The Age of American Unreason. All of this after these messages at WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Neurological Associates, where Dr. Ronald Dorbish joins the team of established neurosurgeons with training from Columbus's Doctors Hospital. Information about Dr. Dorbish and the other new physicians is at neuroassociates.com.
Come on, you know you want it.
It brings those thoughts of your mama being like,
You know you've got to have it.
Free ice cream!
Free!
Ice cream!
Free!
Really? Not a joke?
Well, don't fight the feeling. Come and get it.
I got the feeling.
Get the latest news and a whole lot more
baby, I got the
on NPR's Day to Day.
Day to Day begins at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jarovich. Thanks for joining us for Open Line. It's 70 degrees at 10:30. The switch to digital TV is coming. You can help older adults with the switch by donating your unneeded converter box coupons to WOSU. Visit WOSU.org/DTV to apply for your coupons today, or call 292-9678 for more information. Get perspective on all the day's news with All Things Considered and the latest business news on Marketplace, weekdays starting at 4, now on WOSU 89.7 FM.
Support for WOSU comes from Meijer. In partnership with the Nature Conservancy, Meijer is helping customers identify and select non-invasive plants for Ohio backyards. Information is available at nature.meijer.com.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. My guest, commentator Susan Jacoby, says that anti-intellectualism and anti-rationalism are flourishing in America in a mix that includes, she says, addiction to infotainment, every form of superstition and credulity, and an educational system that does a poor job of teaching not only basic skills, but the logic underlying those skills. And again, Susan Jacoby quotes Thomas Jefferson, "If a nation expects to be ignorant and free," he said, "in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be." We'll find out more. Susan Jacoby's new book, The Age of American Unreason. We're at 614-292-8513. You can email comments or questions to openline at WOSU.org. Susan, tell me about the education piece here. You say our educational system does not do a good job of teaching us how to think logically. Is that right?
Well, I think not only that, it's funny. It all dates back to the 60s, but a lot of liberals at the end of the 60s, early 70s said our educational system is just stuffing us with facts. We have to teach people how to think. The problem with this is it sets up an opposition between facts and thinking. A decent educational system, and I'm not talking about university level, I'm talking about elementary and secondary school education, teaches both facts and logic. There isn't any necessary opposition between the two. What we got sort of in the 60s and 70s, we got de-emphasis on memorization. The problem is that you need both. You need a framework of facts. For example, let's talk about something so important to today's politics, understanding of the history of race in this country. Well, you can't just do that in schools by teaching tolerance and respect for other cultures, which is important. But you need to know how the history of race in this country developed. And to do that, you have to understand some very basic chronological facts. The Constitution sanctioned slavery. We fought a war then, 70 years later, which resulted in the end of slavery, which was followed after Reconstruction by the reimposition of Jim Crow and de facto slavery in the South, and so forth and so forth. If you don't know the dates, if you don't know, as a quarter of American students don't, the dates of the Civil War, then how do you think about, you know, the timeline and the evolution and the ways in which slavery and racism affect us today? If you don't know the facts, you can't understand the realities underneath the facts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never bought that idea that you don't need facts and you don't need, in some cases, rote memorization. You could always look it up.
But they're all part of the same thing. The one doesn't rule out the other. Of course, what schools need to be doing is trying to teach kids thinking about things and logical thought processes, but that involves facts too.
Yeah. And you see a general failure in our schools to do that?
Well, every 2 years there's an international evaluation conducted of how American students do. I'm not talking about those stupid standardized tests involved in the No Child Left Behind bill. How our students are doing in science and math in comparison to students from other developed nations. In science, we're mediocre. In math, we're close to dead last. These things are part of how to think, and they're part of facts. Things like, for example, if you say, talk about taxes in the election, if people don't understand what 1% means or what 1/4 means, then how can you talk about how taxes affect a certain proportion of the population? Our knowledge of our own history is very poor. Polls by the National Constitution Center show repeatedly fewer than half of Americans can name any of the rights guaranteed by the First Amendment. Mm. And the younger people are, the lower their knowledge is.
Sad to say. And what is it that's going on in the classrooms now that you think accounts for this?
I don't know exactly. What I think is really that we have failed to improve. In other words, I think one of the things that's happened is that the sum of knowledge has increased, but our ability, you know, and the resources we allocate to education have not. You know, we all say, Americans say, you know, we value education. No country has ever, in theory, valued education more than America. But we show what we really think of education by the salaries we pay elementary and secondary school teachers. I don't understand how people can say they value education and say that the quality of education has nothing to do with what you pay teachers. Mm-hmm. It does. And teachers don't make nearly as much as other professionals. You think if teachers were making $100,000 a year instead of $40,000 a year, that there wouldn't be more qualified teachers in the schools?
In other words, you're going to get a better pool of applicants for teaching.
Put your money where your mouth is, yeah.
Okay. We have an email here from Derek. He's upset with media polls. He says, there's a lack of demand for evidence in reporting. And he says, what drives me crazy is that after the 2 + 2 = 4 versus 2 + 2 = 5 debate with equal time for each side, what often follows is a poll. And he says, and the dumbed-down public gets to weigh in, and the poll results are the next story, and the 2 + 2 = 5 viewpoint is given even more credibility. That's Derek's comment.
That can happen. It depends on the kind of polls you run, though, whether it's a poll of listeners or whether it's a randomized, scientifically conducted poll like a Gallup poll. I think polls are useful just because, I mean the good kind of polls, the ones that are conducted rigorously, not these listener polls of somebody who just tuned into a radio or a TV show. But all they do is they show you a snapshot in time. And they're influenced by a lot of things other than arguments. They're influenced by who looks better on TV. Back in 1960, when there were the first presidential debates between Nixon and Kennedy, people who saw the debate on TV thought that Kennedy had won. People who heard the debate on the radio thought that Nixon had won. Clearly, the way Kennedy looked compared to Nixon influenced the results of those polls.
Mm-hmm. All right, Susan Jacoby, The Age of American Unreason. And Susan is on the phone. Hello, Susan.
Hi, thanks for taking my
call. Another Susan.
I know. I just want to say, as a fellow citizen, I just don't know how to say I finally know I'm not crazy. I cannot believe.
Do you?
I think that you're brilliant. I think that you're incredibly brave to be criticizing the American public on any point. And I think that we need so much more critical thinking, it's just hard to even believe. So I am totally lockstep in your opinion about the rise of irrationality. My theory is, and tell me if you would agree at all, is that everything is basically advertisement and marketing. I, even in my personal life, people just socially, it's almost as if no one really knows the difference at all, which would make sense to me that things that are completely unproven would be truth because it holds back political movements. I think of the feminist movement. I've been listening all my life about how women make 70 cents to the dollar, and all of a sudden it's cool to be a feminist again because the advertising has changed on what that means as a woman. So do you have a comment about that?
Well, certainly marketing has a lot to do with everything and which ideas are marketed and which aren't. But to pick up on your point about criticizing the public, I mean, you certainly aren't going to hear it in this campaign.
No.
what politicians all say, whether they're new style or old style, is they'll say to the public, you were lied to. Whatever you don't like is the fault
right.
of Washington. And if we change Washington, but they never ask, what is it that made us so willing to be lied to, which is really a fundamental question. Now, I recently wrote a piece for the New York Times about the degradation of the word elite, which all elite means is the best. That's all it means, but it's been twisted into something that means snobs, people who drink white wine instead of beer, all of that silly stuff. But I received an email, the Washington Post, some months ago when my book was first published, saying I was nothing but an elitist. I had cited a statistic showing that only 25% of Americans under 25 can find a rock on a map.
But that explains.
But what the guy said in the email was, is he said, you're nothing but an elitist. I don't care if my car mechanic can find a rock on a map. I only care that he can fix my car. Well, what I say is, what could be more elitist than that? The idea that a car mechanic, who is your fellow citizen and fellow voter, isn't capable of knowing where a rock is on a map.
Yeah.
You don't need to be a college graduate or intellectual to know that.
Yeah. Well, I just think that abstract thinking is at an all-time low. I don't even believe anything that comes through the media because, to me, it's all advertising and opinion that they got in an email or a poll and giving the American people what they want. I mean, I just can't believe no one really talks about what's really going on.
We have Susan Jacoby, you mentioned in your book, you contrast the speaking style of some current-day politicians with that of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. You say FDR really tried in his fireside talks. He had people get a map out and took them through the map of Europe and
right.
explained what was going on and tried to really educate people so that they would understand the reasons for possible U.S. involvement in a war.
And there is no reason. In some ways, that would be easier to do today because you can just call up a Google map. But in those days, people sat and listened to the president talk and followed him on their maps for 45 minutes.
Mm.
The assumption now is that no president could command a 45-minute audience. But look, we've seen something else. Just referring back to the primary campaigns, Barack Obama has been criticized a lot for speaking too well, being too well-spoken. And was criticized because pretty speeches are somehow opposed to action. Again, this idea that being well-spoken is somehow opposed to practical action is the essence of anti-intellectualism. It was definitely something the founders did not believe. They were all – the word intellectual wasn't used in the 18th century, but the most important American founders except were all intellectuals.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have been stunned by the idea – that there was some opposition between reading and speaking and doing.
You know, to go back to FDR for a moment, it was amazing to me to read that, indeed, not only did Americans follow along, but there was a big run on maps. People went out and bought maps.
You couldn't buy a map after he said, get yourself a map. They sold, the publishers couldn't print them fast enough for that fireside chat.
Yeah. And of course, today, as you point out, a significant number of people cannot locate Iraq or Saudi Arabia or Iran on a map.
And these are maps with the names of countries written in, by the way. So what it means is they don't know in what part of the world to look for the country whose name is actually on the map.
Susan Jacoby with us this hour, the age of American unreason. Our next caller here, Hal. Hello, Hal. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning, Fred. Interesting program and long overdue, I believe. In this country, it seems to me, over my lifetime, I have seen us go from criticism to critical domestic propaganda and a failure to even consider criticism of domestic American capitalism. It's kind of the third rail of any kind of a conversation, and I'm wondering about that, and I'm kind of wondering about something else. How do you think the press in this country would react if McCain were to choose Dick Cheney as his vice president? Cheney chose himself last time, and after all, he's been so great. Why would the party and the supporters not be thinking of him as a perfect choice once again?
Well, I really am not – I don't know how the press would react, but that's not going to happen. Dick Cheney is not well-liked. I don't think John McCain is stupid enough to pick Dick Cheney as his vice president. So that kind of falls in the hypothetical realm for me. It would be a much criticized choice. And John McCain, who, if only for the reason that he is the age he is not going to choose another old man who has also been sick and who isn't liked. I think that's one question that really falls so far in the realm of the hypothetical that there's no point in answering it. My guess is there would be a lot of criticism.
How do you feel about the domestic propaganda?
What kind of domestic propaganda?
Well, it seems to me that the lack of intellectualism, it goes hand in hand with American domestic propaganda that if you go offshore is viewed completely different than it's viewed in this country, and it's supported to no small degree by capitalism, by corporate sponsorship of people like the O'Reillys and the Limbaughs and et cetera, on and on and on, the whole list of those kinds of people. Who, to a large degree, represent the very topic that you're criticizing.
Well, you're giving examples on the right there, caller. You might give Keith Olbermann as an example on the left as well.
But, yes, absolutely.
I don't know. First of all, I think if America were to turn into a non-capitalist country tomorrow, a lot of the things I'm talking about would still be true. Certainly the marketing of opinions as if they were facts is something that increases the problem. However, I spent a number of years in the Soviet Union when I was younger as a journalist, and all I can tell you is that anti-intellectualism and anti-rationalism are not solely the function of capitalism. I think the idea that somehow capitalism is what is totally causing anti-rationalism in America is something I don't agree with at all.
Okay, Hal, thanks for your call. Susan, if this is all accurate, if indeed we are anti-intellectual as a culture and anti-rational as a culture, and the media is fomenting this or at least aiding and abetting, and politicians are doing nothing to counteract this, and the schools aren't teaching us basic logic and respect for facts and in tandem, how would this all change?
I wish you hadn't asked me that. This is the hook that comes at the end of every interview. What would you recommend? I don't have any broad recommendations. Two things are going to have to happen. One, and this is a very difficult thing. The only thing that gives me hope is I've received so many emails from young parents about this. We're going to have to become more conscious of how we spend our time and how we have our kids spend our time. And this is one of the things I wanted to do with my book is start a cultural conversation about this. I'm not one of these people who thinks that you should raise your children never to watch TV. Obviously, we all have to be computer literate. We live in the world in which we live. But that doesn't mean, and Obama said something, it feels like 100 years ago now, but it was only after the Wisconsin primary a few months ago. He said, he was asked what he was going to do about education. He said one of the first things we have to do as parents is turn off the TV set more, put the video games away more and spend more time talking and reading to our kids. That's the hardest thing to do, to become conscious of how you spend your time. And it's not a matter of one thing or the other. There's nothing wrong with watching television for an hour or putting kid in front of a video for an hour because you want to have an adult conversation when you come home from work. It's when that hour turns into 2, 3, 4, 5 and displaces everything else that we get the kind of ignorant culture we have. Nothing wrong with playing a video game for an hour either. But the fact is, young men are the least likely group to read in our culture. And 18 to 25-year-olds in the Nielsen computer ratings, 18 to 25-year-old boys spend 3 to 4 hours a day playing video games. Well, they're certainly not spending their time reading then, are they? So a lot of what matters is we have to think about how we spend our time. But the other thing that's important is we have to stop thinking that there are technological solutions to non-technological problems. And I'll tell you exactly what I mean. Just as I was finishing this book, Bill Gates announced the next generation Microsoft operating system called Windows Vista, which hardly anybody has yet. But one of the things that he said when he announced the new system is that this was going to allow absolute parental controls. It was going to enable parents to control the amount of time and everything their children did on computers. Now, this obviously was Bill Gates, the founder of Microsoft, knows very well that there is no operating system that a bright 10-year-old isn't going to crack within 3 weeks. In other words, the idea that there is a technological fix to kids for kids who are hooked on video and MySpace and YouTube and all of that is wrong. The problem is that what we're taught and brought up to value, and Bill Gates, Microsoft founder knows that. Bill Gates, the parent, probably has actually convinced himself that this is true, that he and Melinda are going to be able, with this wonderful new operating system, to control what their children do on the computer. No, they're not. What kids respond to is parental example, not parental controls.
So somehow our values within the family is there going to be a shift in consciousness here? Huh?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely necessary, and I don't know if that can happen. I certainly wouldn't make a case that because I've gotten a few thousand emails from concerned parents that this is going to happen. I do think in this campaign, Obama is beginning to talk about it. I was hoping the candidates would talk about it more. So far, they've rejected. There's a group that wants them to have a debate wholly on science and education. So far, both of them have rejected this idea because nobody thinks that Americans will listen, which is pretty depressing in itself.
Yeah. Now, Senator McCain invited Senator Obama to have about a dozen town hall meetings in which they would answer questions. And of course, Senator Obama said he would, I believe, have one. That sounded like a format in which you could have some rational discussion.
Well, depends on the town hall, doesn't it?
Well, it does. Yeah.
I'm all for town hall meetings Yes, I'm all for town hall meetings, and more than that, in the big president, I don't really think Americans are going to be paying a lot of attention before the conventions to any of this. I kind of think there's a fatigue from the long Democratic primary that's set in, and probably they'd be better off to have their town hall meetings after both of their conventions and after they're nominated.
Sure.
Certainly the kind of debate formats we've had in recent years, in which the candidates are literally prevented from talking to each other, and newsmen who look like wooden sticks ask the questions. That's a bad debate format, and apparently that's not going to be the case this year. The debate is not going to be run by the TV networks this year, so we'll see.
Yeah, again, everything depends on the quality of the candidates and the quality of their decision to approach things rationally, at length, patiently, et cetera, right?
Well, who knows?
Who knows?
We don't really know yet. I think in spite of the fact that Obama and McCain are swiping at each other, I think the campaign really hasn't gotten into gear yet. And I don't think until after both the Democratic and the Republican conventions, I don't think people are really going to be focusing on it.
All right. Let's quickly call us. We have time for a few more callers if you are concise. Hello, Rick.
Yes. I had a couple questions. First of all, What is a good way to get just general news? I get my news usually online, and is there a website that's any better than any other site? And also, in terms of finding another perspective, what is a good way? I lean to the left, and what's a good site to find for people that lean to the right? Because the ones that I have seen don't really impress me very much.
Okay. Well, look, what I would do is I'll tell you something else I do. What I would do is if I were getting all my news online, I'd read the New York Times or the Washington Post every day. I'd read the Wall Street Journal, which, although it has a very conservative ownership, has very solid reporting on the economy, which I think that supplies a lot for both liberals and conservatives. But one thing I would definitely do if I were an online acquirer of information, I think this would be a stunning surprise for a lot of Americans, is I would look at the websites of newspapers like the Times of London or The Guardian or Le Monde, which also has an English language site. See how differently the same things that are presented in our press, see how different they look to other educated countries.
And also in terms of opinion on the right, you have the Town Hall website, you have National Review Online as a couple of good sources for conservative opinion. Let us go. Bruce, quickly, your question.
Good morning. I'm with the Truth Movement Worldwide, and what's the psychological problems with people subconsciously knowing they've been presented with the truth but rejecting it because it doesn't fit their framework, and how can we help them?
What Lakoff says is there's nothing you can do. Once people have a certain frame, no facts will change their mind. He may be right, but I think certainly in terms of public education, what we have to do, not everybody has – it depends on how rigid the frame is. Not everybody has a frame that's absolutely rigid. A lot of people have frames that have gates and little picture windows and things like that. I think it would be true that there's no use presenting facts if a frame is completely rigid, but not all of us have completely rigid frames. There's room for a lot of people for frames that allow for some openings in the frame. And that's what I think that evidence-based people have to do, is they have to look for that group of people whose frame is a little more flexible.
Okay. Time for a quick question from Jay. Hello, Jay.
Yeah, hi. I don't have a question so much as I don't disagree that the country is in a sad state, but I don't think that education or the media is the problem. I think people are too complacent. They're too happy. They're not willing to sacrifice. I think that maybe it's just that we haven't gotten ourselves to a position yet where it's so bad that we feel like maybe we should do something. And I believe that's a major problem for the country.
Well, maybe, you know what? Maybe this is a teachable moment, because, in fact, what the polls all show now is that Americans are not happy and complacent. They're worried as hell about a lot of things. I think the real question is whether people are worried enough, as you say, to take it upon themselves and not just to think that blaming a group of elitists or blaming Washington, whether on the right and the left, absolves them of their responsibility in this matter. But I feel that American society, the fabric of complacency is a lot thinner now than it looks. It could be a teachable moment if anybody was willing to try to do it.
Mm-hmm. When less than 20% of Americans say that the country is headed in the right direction.
That's right. I do think an earlier caller talked about domestic propaganda. There's one bit of American self-imagery that has done us no good. We are constantly told by everybody, we're number one, we're number one, we're number one. This doesn't help you improve. And in fact, in education, we're not number one. We're fast not becoming number one in science, which we were for a long time. And I think the piercing of this we're number one armor may be taking place, and it's a good thing. I don't think a country which is constantly telling itself we're number one is willing to look at the ways in which we're not number one and what we need to do to ameliorate that situation.
Yeah, and in the final minute, I think it's especially difficult to do that if like many of us, you haven't visited other countries to see, in fact, how people are utterly, utterly fine in those other countries. They don't necessarily have a desire to come to America as the golden opportunity. In many of those other countries, they're doing fine on their own.
Yeah. A lot of, you know, I'm sure if you ask most Americans who are now dissatisfied with our health care system, they would still say we have the best system in the world. But it's the best system in the world only for the few at the top who can afford the kind of health insurance and doctors that only money can buy here. Mm-hmm. If they visited these countries, which our politicians yell about socialized medicine for, they would find that middle-class people are a lot less worried about their health futures than they are here, because they know they're not going to go bankrupt if they get sick.
Susan Jacoby's new book is The Age of American Unreason. Susan, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you and your audience as well.
When we come back, Nebraska Senator Chuck Hagel joins us to talk about non-military means of executing foreign policy on listener-supported WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus, on the web at WOSU.org. This is WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the Columbus Metropolitan Club, presenting a variety of speakers on the relevant issues of today. More information is available at www.columbusmetroclub.org.